DNA of our babies. And the biologists have been the big success story here, I think, that should inspire us AI researchers today, because it was deemed so risky that we would lose control over our species back in the 70s that we actually decided as a world society to not do human cloning and to not edit the DNA of our offspring. And here we are with a really flourishing biotech industry that's doing so much good in the world. And so the lesson here for AI is that we should become more like biology. We should recognize that in biology, no company has the right to just launch a new medicine and start selling it in supermarkets without first convincing experts from the government that this is safe. That's why we have the Food and Drug Administration in the U.S., for example. And with particularly high-risk uses of AI, we should aspire to something very similar, where the onus is really on the companies to prove that something extremely powerful is safe before it gets deployed.
Last fall, the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy published a blueprint for an AI Bill of Rights and called it a vision for protecting our civil rights in the algorithmic age. This comes amidst growing awareness about racial biases embedded in artificial intelligence and how impacts the use of facial recognition programs by law enforcement and more. I want to bring into this conversation with Professors Tegmark and Abengio Tawana Petty, Director of Policy and Advocacy at the Algorithm Justice League, longtime digital and data rights activist. Tawana Petty, welcome to Democracy Now! You are not only warning people about the future, you're talking about the uses of AI right now and how they can be racially discriminatory. Can you explain?
Yes. Thank you for having me, Amy. Absolutely. I must say that the contradictions have been heightened with the godfather of AI and others speaking out and authoring these particular letters that are talking about these futuristic potential harms. However, many women have been warning about the existing harms of artificial intelligence many years prior to now. Timnit Gebru, Dr. Joy Bullamwini, and so many others, Safia Noble, Ruha Benjamin, and Dr. Alondra Nelson, which you just mentioned, the blueprint for an AI Bill of Rights, which is asking for five core principles: safe and effective systems, algorithmic discrimination protections, data privacy, notice and explanation, and human alternatives consideration and fallback. And so at the Algorithmic Justice League, we have been responding to existing harms of algorithmic discrimination that date back many years prior to this almost robust narrative reshaping conversation that has been happening over the last several months with artificial general intelligence. So we're already seeing harms with algorithmic discrimination in medicine. We're seeing the pervasive surveillance that is happening with law enforcement using face detection system to target community members during protests, squashing not only our civil liberties and rights to organize and protest, but also the misidentifications that are happening with regard to false arrests that we've seen. Two very prominent cases started off in Detroit. And so there are many examples of existing harms that it would have been really great to have these voices of mostly white men who are in the tech industry who did not pay attention to the voices of all those women who were lifting up these issues many years ago. And they're talking about these futuristic possible risks when we have so many risks that are happening today.
So, Professor Max Tegmark, if you could respond to what Tawana Petty said, and the fact that others have also said that the risks have been vastly overstated in that letter, and more importantly, given what Tawana has said, that it distracts from already existing effects of artificial intelligence that are widely in use already.
I think this is a really important question here. There are people who say that one of these kinds of risk distracts from the other. I strongly support everything we heard here from Tawana. I think these are all very important problems, examples of how we're giving too much control already to machines. But I strongly disagree that we should have to choose about worrying about one kind of risk or the other. That's like saying we should stop working on cancer prevention because it distracts from stroke prevention. These are all incredibly important risks. I've spoken up a lot on social justice risks as well and threats. And, you know, it just plays into the hands of the tech lobbyists if it looks like there's infighting between people who are trying to rein in big tech for one reason and people are trying to rein in big tech for other reasons. Let's all work together and realize that society, just like society can work on both cancer prevention and stroke prevention, we have the resources for this. We should be able to deal with all the crucial social justice issues and also make sure that we don't go extinct. Extinction is not that something in the very distant future, as we heard from Yoshua Bengio. You know, we might be losing total control of our society relatively soon. It could happen in the next few years. It could happen this decade. And once we're all extinct, you know, all these other issues cease to even matter. Let's work together, tackle all the issues so that we can actually have a good future for everybody.
So, Tawana Petty, and then I want to bring back in Yoshua Bengio. Tawana Petty, what needs to happen at the national level, you know, U.S. regulation? And then I want to compare what's happening here, what's happening in Canadian regulation, the EU, European Union, which seems like it's about to put in the first comprehensive set of regulations. Tawana.
Right, absolutely. So the blueprint was a good model to start with that we're seeing some states adopt and try to roll out their versions of an AI Bill of Rights. The president issued an executive order to strengthen racial equity and support underserved communities across the federal government, which is addressing specifically algorithmic discrimination. You have the National Institute of Standards and Technologies that issued an AI risk management framework that breaks down the various types of biases that we find within algorithmic systems like computational, systemic, statistical, and human cognitive. And there are so many other legislative opportunities that are happening on a federal level. You see the FTC speaking up, the Federal Trade Commission on algorithmic discrimination. You have the Equal Employment Opportunity Corporation that has issued statements. You have the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, who has been adamant about the impact that algorithmic systems have on us when data brokers are amassing these mass amounts of data that have been extracted from community members. So I agree that there needs to be some collaboration and cooperation. But we see situations like Dr. Timnit Gebru was terminated from Google for warning us before ChatGPT was launched upon the millions of people as a large language model. And so cooperation has not been lacking on the side of the folks who work in ethics. To the contrary, these companies have terminated their ethics departments and people who have been warning about existing harms.
And Professor Bengio, if you can talk about the level of regulation and what you think needs to happen and who is putting forward models that you think could be effective.
So first of all, I'd like to make a correction here. I have been involved in really working towards dealing with the negative social impact of AI for many years. In 2016, I worked on the Montreal Declaration for the Responsible Development of AI, which is very much centered on ethics and social injustice. And since then, I've created an organization, the AI for Humanity Department in the research center that I head, which is completely focused on human rights. So I think these accusations are just false. And as Max was saying, we don't need to choose between fighting cancer and you know, fighting heart disease. We need to do all of those things. But better than that, what is needed in the short term, at least, building up these regulations is going to help to mitigate all those risks. And so I think we should really work together rather than having these accusations.
Professor Benjiu, I'd like to ask you about precisely some of the work that you have done with respect to human rights and artificial intelligence. Earlier this month, a conference on artificial intelligence was held in Kigali, Rwanda, and you were among those who were pushing for the conference to take place in Africa. Could you explain what happened at that conference? 2,000 people, I believe, attended, and what African researchers and scientists had to say, you know, about what the goods are, the public good that could come from artificial intelligence, and why they felt, in fact, one of the questions that was raised is, why wasn't there more discussion about the public good rather than just the immediate risks or future risks?
Yes. I've been working, in addition to the ethics questions, I've been working a lot on the applications of AI in the area of what's called AI for social good. So that includes things like medical applications, environmental applications, social justice applications. And in those areas, it is particularly important that we bring to the fore the voices of the people who could the most benefit and also the most suffer from the development of AI. And in particular, the voices of Africans have not been very present. As we know, the development of this technology has been mostly in rich countries in the West. And so as a member of the board of the ICLEAR conference, which is one of the main conferences in the field, I've been pushing for many years for us to have the event taking place in Africa. And so this year was the first after, it was supposed to be before the pandemic, but it was pushed. And what we saw is an amazing presence of African researchers and students at levels that we couldn't see before. And the reason, I mean, there are many reasons, but mostly it's a question of accessibility. Currently in many Western countries, the visas for African researchers or from developing countries are very difficult to get. I've been fighting, for example, the Canadian government a few years ago when we had the NeurIPS conference in Canada, and there were hundreds of African researchers who were denied a visa, and we had to go one by one in order to try to make them come. So I think that it's important that the decisions we're going to take collectively, which involve everyone on Earth about AI, be taken in a the most inclusive possible ways, and for that reason we need not just to think about what's going on in the US or Canada, but across the world. We need not just to think about the risks of AI that we've been discussing today, but also how do we actually invest more in areas of application where companies are not going, maybe because it's not profitable, but they're really important to address, for example, the UN Sustainable Development Goals and help reduce misery and deal, for example, with medical issues that are not present in the West, but are like infectious diseases that are mostly in poorer countries.
And can you talk, Professor Benjiu, about AI and not only nuclear war, but, for example, the issue Jody Williams, a Nobel laureate, has been trying to bring attention to for years, killer robots that can kill with their bare hands. The whole issue of AI when it comes to war and who fights these wars.
Yeah, this is also something I've been actively involved in for many years, campaigns to raise awareness about the danger of killer robots, also known more precisely as lethal autonomous weapons. And when we did this, 5 or 10 years ago, it was still something that sounded like science fiction. But actually, there's been reports that drones have been equipped with AI capabilities, especially computer vision capabilities, face recognition, that have been used in the field in Syria, and maybe this is happening in Ukraine. So it's already something that we know how to build. Like, we know that the science behind building these killer drones, not killer robots. We don't know yet how to build robots that work really well. But if you take drones that we know how to fly in a fairly autonomous way, and if these drones have weapons on them, and if these drones have cameras, then AI could be used to target the drone to specific people, and kill in an illegal way specific targets. That's incredibly dangerous. It could destabilize the sort of military balance that we know today. I don't think that people are paying enough attention to that. And in terms of the existential risk, the real issue here is that if the super intelligent AI also has controls of dangerous weapons, then it's just going to be very difficult for us to reduce the risks of catastrophic risks. We don't want to put guns in the hands of people who are unstable, or in the hands of children that we that could act in ways that could be dangerous. And that's the same problem here.
Professor Tegmark, if you could respond on this question of the military uses of possible military uses of artificial intelligence, and the fact, for instance, that China is now a Nikkei study, the Japanese publication study earlier this year concluded that, in fact, China is producing more research papers on artificial intelligence than the U.S. is. You've said, of course, that this is not akin to an arms race, but rather to a suicide race. So if you could talk about the regulations that are already in place from the Chinese government on the applications of artificial intelligence compared to the EU and the US.
That's a great question. The recent change now this week, when the idea of extinction from AI goes mainstream, I think will actually help the geopolitical rivalry between East and West get more harmonious, because until now, most policymakers have just viewed AI as something that gives you great power. So everybody wanted it first. And there was this idea that whoever gets artificial general intelligence that can outsmart humans somehow wins. But now that it's going mainstream, the idea that actually it could easily end up that with everybody just losing, and the big winners are the machines that are left over after we're all extinct, it suddenly gives the incentives to the Chinese government and the American government and European governments that are aligned. Because the Chinese government does not want to lose control over its society any more than any Western government does. And for this reason, we can actually see that China has already put tougher restrictions on their own tech companies than we in America have on American companies. And it's not because we don't have to persuade the Chinese, in other words, to take precautions, because it's not in their interest to go extinct. You know, once, it doesn't matter if you're American or Canadian, is once you're extinct.
I know.
And I should add also, just so that doesn't sound like hyperbole, this idea of extinction, the idea that everybody on Earth could die. It's important to remember that roughly half the species on this planet that were here, a few thousand years ago, have been driven extinct already by humans, right? So extinction happens. And it's also important to remember why we drove all these other species extinct. It wasn't because necessarily we hated the West African black rhinoceros or certain species that lived in coral reefs. You know, when we went ahead and just chopped down the rainforests or ruined the coral reefs by climate change, that was kind of a side effect. We just wanted resources. We had other goals that just didn't align with the goals of those other species. And because we were more intelligent than them, they were powerless to stop us. This is exactly what Joshua Bengio was warning about. We also for humanity here. If we lose control of our planet to more intelligent entities, and their goals are just not aligned with ours, we'll be powerless to prevent massive changes that they might do to our biosphere here on Earth, and we might, and that's the way in which we might get wiped out the same way that the other half of the species did. And let's not do that. There's so much goodness, so much wonderful stuff that AI can do for all of us if we work together to harness. To steer this in the good direction, curing all those diseases that have stumped us, lifting people out of poverty, stabilizing the climate, and helping life on Earth flourish for a very, very, very long time to come. I hope that by raising the awareness of the risks, we're going to get to work together to build that great future with AI.
And finally, Tawana Petty, moving from the global to the local, we're here in New York, and the New York City Mayor Eric Adams has announced the New York Police Department is acquiring some new semi-autonomous robotic dogs in the coming in this period. You have looked particularly about their use and their discriminatory use in communities of color. Can you respond?
Yes, and I'll also say that Ferndale, Michigan, where I live, has also acquired robot dogs. And so these are situations that are currently happening on the ground in an organization, law enforcement, that is still suffering from systemic racial bias with over-policed and hyper-surveilled marginalized communities. So we're looking at these robots now being given an opportunity to police and surveil already hyper-surveil communities. And Amy, I would just like an opportunity to address really briefly the previous comments. My commentary is not to attack any of the existing efforts or previous efforts or years worth of work that these two gentlemen have been involved in. I greatly respect efforts to address racial inequity and ethics in artificial intelligence. And I agree that we need to have some collaborative efforts in order to address these existing things that we're experiencing. People are already dying from health discrimination with algorithms. People are already being misidentified by police using facial recognition. Government services are utilizing corporations like ID.me to use facial recognition to access benefits. And so we have a lot of opportunities to collaborate currently to prevent the existing threats that we're currently facing.
Well, Tawana Petty, I want to thank you for being with us, Director of Policy and Advocacy at the Algorithmic Justice League, speaking to us from Detroit. Yoshua Bengio, founder and scientific director of NILA, the Quebec AI Institute, considered one of the godfathers of AI, speaking to us from Montreal, and Max Tegmark, MIT professor. We'll link to your Time magazine piece, The Don't Look Up Thinking That Could Doom Us with AI. We thank you all for being with us. Coming up, we look at student debt as the House approves a bipartisan deal to suspend the debt ceiling. Back in 20 seconds.
I'm walking towards nothing on this desolate road. I'm searching for comfort, a place to call my own. I'm scared of where I'm heading. When will this fear subside? When will I find the answer?
If I Own Today by Shayna Steele. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Shehwi, and today's show looking at how the bipartisan deal to suspend the debt ceiling would end President Biden's federal student loan payment pause, force payments to resume September 1st, and limit new student debt moratoriums. On Tuesday, Democratic Congressmember Ayanna Pressley filed an amendment to remove this section, saying, quote, "The pause on student loan payments has been life-changing for families across the country." For more, we're joined by Braxton Brewington, Press Secretary of the Debt Collective, a group working to end the student loan crisis. Braxton, welcome back to Democracy Now! We only have a few minutes. Can you respond to the passage of the debt ceiling legislation and how it impacts student loan?
This is President Biden turning his back on student debtors. What this provision in the debt ceiling does is essentially codify an end to the student loan pause. It says not only that should not only should student loans, should student debtors have to resume payments on September 1st, but that the pause can never be extended again. And so what that risks is that should June this month, the Supreme Court rule against student debt relief, student loan borrowers are going to be in what could be the worst financial position they've ever been in, which is going through COVID, having a student debt crisis, but not having their student debt relief and having to resume costly payments.
And Braxton, if you could give us a sense, I mean, what is the scale of the student debt crisis and what impact is this likely to have on literally tens of millions of student debtors in the U.S.?
Student debt is the second largest household debt type in the entire country. In 2019, people defaulted on their student debt every 26 seconds. A million people a year defaulted on their student debt. Senior citizens had their Social Security checks garnished. Veterans had their wages garnished. People aren't able to purchase a home. They're not able to have children or start a small business or start a family. And so the crisis of student debt is a large one before COVID, now exacerbated by COVID, where people have lost their health insurance, their wages have been stagnated, or some have even declined. We're looking at a situation now where people after the pandemic don't actually have any relief because of student debt possibly not going through because of the Supreme Court. And that's why the backstop of the pause is so important, because it's really the only thing keeping student debtors afloat from not falling into financial decline.
So what do you think can happen right now?
Well, the vote is set to go through soon on the Senate side, and we're still pressuring members of Congress to vote a no on the provision of codifying the end of the payment pause. And we're also pressuring President Biden to uphold his promise to implement relief no matter what the Supreme Court says. This conservative court, which has frankly ignored the facts of this case through every step of the process, there was no fact-finding process. We're nervous that the Supreme Court is going to ignore the rule of law, ignore reason, and rule against student debt relief. What President Biden can then do is use other legal tools at his disposal to ensure that people get the relief that they've already applied for, that they've already been approved for, so that we don't come out of COVID-19 where people are in such a really bad financial situation. The Biden administration should declare student debt an emergency on its own. There's no reason for the Biden administration to put his hands behind his back and allow the Republicans to tie him to ending the payment pause and never being able to take action on this really important domestic issue again.
You tweeted, if I were a reporter, I would ask the White House what they'll do if they sign a debt ceiling deal that permanently ends the student debt pause, but the Supreme Court rules against student debt relief. Have you posed this question to the Biden administration?
We have. And so far, the Biden administration has said they remain confident in their case that they argued before the Supreme Court. I think our response to that is that the White House can't see the future. And so if we are in a scenario where this conservative Supreme Court, which we know several members of this court have been corrupted and even bribed, if we're in a position where the Supreme Court rules against student debt relief, the Biden administration, because of this debt ceiling deal, will have removed their leverage in ensuring that student debtors are able to stay financially afloat. And so it's not too late. The vote hasn't happened yet. We're encouraging members of Congress and the Biden administration to strike this provision from the deal so that student loan borrowers are not in such a precarious, bad economic situation akin to the student debt crisis before COVID.
Braxton Brewington, I want to thank you for being with us, Press Secretary of the Debt Collective, a group working to end the student loan crisis. That does it for our show, Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warrenoff, Charina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio. Special thanks to Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Join me, Robin, every Friday at noon for Roots and Berries. Tune in to hear bluegrass, old-time music, and other rootsy little nuggets with a focus on Canadian players, singers, and pickers. That's Roots and Berries, Fridays over the noon hour, right here on CJSF 90.1 FM.
Ooh, la, 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 la. Open Mic.
Open Mic on CJSF 90.1 is where you can listen to fresh new releases from any genre, any day of the week. Visit cjsf.ca for the latest open mic schedule.
Hey, welcome to Open Mic. I'm your host, Varian. That was kind of weird.